Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are so many aspects of this war that we need robust intelligence on. And a man who was for many years a career professional in the highest reaches of the Central Intelligence Agency, responsible for collecting such intelligence the old-fashioned way, as they say, is a former senior operations officer and chief of station with the Central Intelligence Agency's Directorate of Operations. His name is Brad Johnson. He has held senior positions, as I say, both domestically and in a number of places abroad. He can't talk much about them, unfortunately, but he can talk about, more generally, the state of our intelligence, particularly as it relates to this very, very important function of collecting and evaluating and making sense of human intelligence. And it's always a delight to have a chance to visit with him. Brad Johnson, among other things, is the founder of Americans for Intelligence Reform and an active contributor to the public policy debate. We're always delighted to have him with us. Brad, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, thank you so much. It's always great to speak with you.
You've had firsthand experience with the dangerous business of recruiting and running spies for our government, for our nation's security in some very dangerous places around the world. Talk a little bit about the importance of human intelligence, or HUMINT, as it's called in the shorthand, in the kind of environment we're in today, Brad.
Well, certainly because of kind of the chaotic world that we're in now, we're faced with dangers from a lot of different sources to one degree or another, some greater, some lesser, but still threats. So it's not so centralized as it used to be. So it's not like you can face off with the old Soviet Union and it's kind of a one against one, state entities against state entities, army against army, that sort of thing. It's much more broken down. So the importance of human intelligence goes up and up and up and up, more important than ever. And it's knowing the plans and intentions, of course, is one of the principal concepts of human intelligence, knowing the plans and intentions of any group, and where some of these groups are much more horizontal in their organization. They're broken down, like you've seen Al-Qaeda in particular, ISIS as well, these sorts of terrorist groups. They've gone more horizontal in their organization because if you're vertical and have a one boss and then two lieutenants and down down the pyramid of organization, it's easy for us to get those pieces and put them together and take them out. So that human piece of recruiting into these groups to find out their plans and intentions is of extreme importance. It's always been important anyway, because knowing that, you know, some country has 100 tanks on the border from overhead photography is one thing, but knowing what they're going to do with those 100 tanks, is it a training exercise or are they going across the border tomorrow morning at dawn? And the way you find that out is human intelligence. And one of the things not often heralded for the important aspect that it contributes is human often drives the boat for a lot of other things, of other types of intelligence, because it tells you where to look or who to listen to. You find out who those important players are. So HUMINT is one of those things that was, spying was discussed in the Bible. It's an ancient concept, and the need for it is never, ever going to go away. We must always maintain that capability.
But I would argue that that's especially true at the moment when so many of the other very sophisticated techniques and technologies that we've used for intelligence collection in lieu of the dangerous business, as I say, of spying, have been compromised. often by people inside the United States or inside the intelligence community itself, whether it's employees or contractors. And so it just simply adds further urgency to what you're talking about. And yet, Brad Johnson, as you know so well, one of the things that John Brennan, the former Central Intelligence Agency director, who's become quite notorious for a variety of reasons, did as the leader of our most important agency for intelligence collection, namely the CIA, was a frontal assault, as I understand it, on our human capabilities. Talk about that if you can.
Absolutely. Yeah, much of this was publicized. Of course, some of the details are still secret, classified. But what he did is what he called a modernization. Now, I think it was quite purposeful in his intent. He never liked Humint per se. He always thought and would say things to that effect on some of his interviews, particularly NPR, that he just thought that Humint spying against another country was sort of a disgrace. So
and we don't steal people's secrets, as I think the way he put it at one point, right?
Exactly right. You know, the old concept being gentlemen don't read other gentlemen's mail sort of thing, and which, of course, is so counterproductive to the national security of the United States of America. It's almost a crime.
Not to say wrong as well.
That's right. Exactly. So what he did with the modernization program was he beefed up something that was very important, and that's the technical means of collection and of various different types. So he reorganized to beef that up and make it a far more robust program, which now that half of it, if you will, was fine and correct and no arguments with any of that part. But he also used that as a pretext, as a cover to destroy the human aspect of it. And that is the Directorate of Operations, where the cadre, people like myself, worked. And that was where all the expertise was developed. To run good spy programs, if you will, to recruit reporting assets or reporting agents in on a worldwide basis. So what he did was just eliminated that and created these mission centers. But the problem with that was then you just create a mix of people so that analysts and people who were supposed to be doing operations and so were basically just one big happy family in a mission center. And so anybody could apply for any job, which remains, you know, the case to this day. And now they've started to try and turn that around a little bit. It was one of the things that Mike Pompeo tried to institute. And they are being paid lip service for turning these things around. And they're, if you look at the ads that are coming out of the CIA trying to hire people, they're advertising like they used to for operations people. But there's inherent problems with the new system. You do not have an operations cadre. You don't have operational divisions. So that new person that comes in doesn't get trained by experienced operations people. They don't have tour after tour after tour as operations officer where they gain all the experience that they need. And it's one of those things to create a chief of station at a larger station who understands how to do this, how to bring up the people working for him to become fully functioning operations officers, it's a 20-year process.
Yeah. We have to pause just for a moment, Brad Moore, with Brad Johnson, these days of Americans for Intelligence Reform, a career clandestine services intelligence officer, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Brad Johnson for a second segment today, discussing with him the state of American intelligence, a critical capability in particular in the kind of dangerous world we're in at the moment. Brad Johnson was a career intelligence professional in the clandestine services of the United States government's Central Intelligence Agency, and we're talking with him these days about it in an unclassified context. He's also the founder of a nonprofit organization called Americans for Intelligence Reform. And reform, of course, or modernization is one of the things, as you mentioned, Brad, that we were told John Brennan was about when he was CIA director. It seems as though he was about a lot of other things, too, including utilizing our intelligence capabilities to spy on a political campaign and candidate, namely Donald Trump, and to try to manufacture, with help from foreign intelligence services, evidently, evidence that would create a basis, a pretext for a counterintelligence investigation of first candidate Trump and his team and then his presidency. Can you very quickly walk us through what role Brennan played in all of that, as well as this business we discussed in the previous segment about, well, taking down critical parts of our intelligence system and capabilities?
Absolutely. And let's not forget, John Brennan was also the same director of the CIA that was spying on Congress, and it used their capability to hack into the Oversight Committee staffers who were looking at the CIA information. He denied it vehemently for a long time and, of course, was caught and had to apologize publicly for it. Now, so highly political.
Which speaks to his character and truthfulness, I think it's fair to say, don't you?
Oh, yes. There's no question whatsoever. I mean, we all know what John Brennan is like, and that's merely one example of many, and we can kind of touch on some of those. But yes, John Brennan was absolutely a central figure in what we've seen develop now, the Spygate scandal. And I think it's clear that what happened is the Democrats had a very serious problem. And let's not forget, he was a Hill staffer, Democratic Party apparatchik. Somebody that was working for the Democratic Party for a long time. So there's no question of where his loyalties lie. And the Democrats had a real problem because of WikiLeaks and later the Wiener computer, so that these many tens of thousands of classified documents were out there. And they had to have a reason how these escaped. So naturally, what they wanted to do was blame their enemies. And for them, the enemy is the Republican Party. So they came up with this program, and they naturally turned to their man who works on the overseas issues, which was John Brennan, as then director of the CIA. And I think that was the origin of it. I would phrase it that as this starts to be uncovered and we start to see these pieces, all roads are leading back to John Brennan. He's connected with these Italian leaders of the three different intelligence agencies in Italy that were all fired. Those were people that he had been dealing with on some of these issues. And you just see these bits and pieces, like the MI6 program where that was the origin of the Steele dossier. These are people that he had been in contact. Now, in this particular case, it's even worse because Peter Strzok was the guy that was traveling to London to also work on this case, meeting with Steele of the Steele dossier fame, and dealing with, and this all was coordinated through the, and let's not forget, station chief at that time was Gina Haspel, handpicked to be in that position as chief of station in London by none other than John Brennan, and now Gina is director of the CIA in her own right.
So wait, pause there just for a second. What you've just said, Brad Johnson, is that the role that was played by John Brennan was direct and personal in orchestrating these various efforts to take down Donald Trump, and that in the process of doing so, he worked with the British intelligence services and one of their former employees, Christopher Steele, in the manufacture and then the dissemination of this dossier. And in the course of those interactions, he relied upon his top representative, the agency's top representative in the United Kingdom, who would have been the chief of station in London, namely Gina Haspel. Gina Haspel is today, as you just mentioned, the CIA director. And so if she was implicated directly in this anti-Trump conspiracy, that's kind of a problem, isn't it, that she's still running the CIA?
Well, there's no question whatsoever. And this was something that I was publicly warning the administration on when they named Gina Haspel to be CIA director. I was pointing out a number of these problems, and this is all interrelated.
But since then, we now know much more about what the agency was doing under John Brennan's leadership, and the dots are that much more unmistakably connected. And I commend you for what you were trying to do. We were trying to do it as well at the time, but not with your considerable authority. But it just seems at this point, this cannot be further ignored. If a serving leader of our intelligence, one of our most important intelligence agencies, as I say, is deeply compromised in this anti-Trump conspiracy.
I agree with you. I think that assessment is dead on. The AG Barr, Attorney General Barr, has made comments in public in interviews that one of the areas he's looking at does include the current CIA director, Gina Haspel. So this is on the radar, and those links, I mean, it cannot have happened any other way. When a senior FBI official goes to debrief somebody in London, England, because of the extremely good liaison relationship that we have with the CIA and MI5, MI6, and FBI, those things are all fully coordinated. So this cannot have taken place in a vacuum. It would never have been considered to be done without full coordination with Gina Haspel. That means she was aware early on, and we don't know to what degree she was involved in the actual planning, but she could not have been unaware of what was going on with the Steele dossier. And now, sitting as CIA director, this is an issue. This is a problem that is going to have to be addressed by probably Attorney General Barr's office, I would assume.
Well, let's hope. And the president has directed everybody to cooperate with him. It'll be very interesting to see whether Ms. Haspel and her immediate subordinates will do that, as they've been directed to do. Hey, very quickly, speaking of human intelligence, there is a story that you have been following closely and working hard to have come out right, and it seems as though it may finally have done. Would you talk us through the story of a former CIA human intelligence clandestine service operative by the name of Sabrina D'Souza, Brad Johnson?
Thank you. The Sabrina D'Souza case is very interesting, and it's evolving as we speak. Now, just very briefly, there was a rendition of an Egyptian terrorist cleric. He was picked up off the streets of Milan, sent back to Egypt. As the case went forward, 25 people were convicted in absentia in Italy for this, what was later tabbed a kidnapping. And all of them basically were pardoned, including a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force who was a part of this this effort. But one person was not. And what Rina D'Souza was, this took place in 2003. And then in 2009, she resigned. She resigned because she was put on a no travel status and was not allowed to go outside of the country. She was foreign born, and her mother was sick with cancer, and so she resigned in order to be able to go visit her mother. John Brennan, for whatever reason, took that very personally, and had behind the scenes then was making sure that Sabrina D'Souza suffered the full weight of the law, and wanted her apparently to actually go to jail in Italy, where she was sentenced to 5 years. She was being held in Portugal, where she was living with her husband, and that was where we came onto the scene and started making the argument that, you know, that this just wasn't right, because no matter what John Brennan thinks of her personally, that's not an excuse to throw her under the bus for this, because she was a U.S. government employee working for the agency, following lawful orders, doing her duty. Apparently, there's a lot of reporting and indications that after Donald Trump won the election in 2006, they apparently surprised everybody, and John Brennan made a trip to Portugal between the time of when Trump won the election and when he assumed office in January, and went to Portugal apparently secretly to discuss with them. And on the heels of that, all of the attitudes towards the Sabrina D'Souza case, which was winding down and going to be released, were reversed. So again, this is where John Brennan apparently has taken all this personally. So she's now in a human rights court in Europe, and they're threatening her because she's going forward with this case, that they're going to rescind the arrangement that had been made, letting her serve out her 5-year sentence under basically house arrest in Portugal, and make her then be extradited and go serve out her time in jail in Italy. So that's the negotiation that's taking place right now. They've offered her a deal that said, give up your case and we'll consider a pardon. And her response so far appears to have been, no, give me the pardon and I'll drop my case. So apparently that's the impasse. So it's ongoing, developing, and hopefully we'll come to a positive resolution. And as I've said many times, the real important thing here is there's a larger problem here, and that is we cannot allow anyone who served a role for the United States government lawfully following orders overseas to then personally serve jail time for things they did under orders. This has got established international law precedent, and we've seen other countries. Iraq, most notably, has then started to talk about going after U.S. military people who were active in Iraq, and once they're out, once they're no longer on active duty, they're fair game. Nobody will protect them. So this has to be stopped, and we have to get this under control and not allow these former USG employees, whether it's DEA, State Department, CIA, DOD, military, we can't allow these people to be targeted by other countries.
Brad Johnson, we are hard out of time. I thank you for your leadership on this front. Keep up the good work, my friend, at Americans for Intelligence Reform, and come back to us again soon.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We have the privilege each week of visiting with one of the country's preeminent authorities on Asia. His name is Gordon Chang. Gordon is the author of three terrific books: The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and most recently, an encounter broadsheet called Losing South Korea. Gordon Chang, welcome back. I had the privilege of spending some time with you in Dallas last week, where you were providing a tour de force, I think it's fair to say, with very, very appreciative audiences. And I thank you for doing it and allowing me to tag along for it.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Frank. And I should mention that you organized much of this, so I really appreciate your putting all of this together.
Well, it's a pleasure. We did do a Committee on the Present Danger-sponsored event where you and Kevin Freeman and Andrew Whitney talked a bit about 5G, and that's something I want to talk with you about today as well. But I did want to start, though, with the big news, it would seem, out of Hong Kong at the moment, which is an outpouring of very, very substantial proportions over the continued inexorable garroting, it seems to me, of what is left of the freedoms that China promised to respect, that the people of Hong Kong had experienced and enjoyed in the latter days, at least, of their time as a British colony. You lived in Hong Kong for a time. I'd be very interested, Gordon, in your sense of what's happening there and what's precipitating some million people, one out of every seven people of Hong Kong, to pour into the streets in opposition to what the Chinese are up to.
Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam is pushing a extradition bill, which would facilitate China taking people out of Hong Kong and bringing them into the mainland courts, which, of course, there's no independence of the judiciary there. About a million people, according to organizers, 1,030,000 took to the streets on Sunday in a demonstration, because many people think that this is Hong Kong's last stand. They believe that if this extradition bill goes through, which is almost certain, then essentially there will be Hong Kong will become just another Chinese city. Beijing will exercise influence in Hong Kong as it does in Beijing and Shanghai. And it's just going to be the end of Hong Kong as a free and independent or at least autonomous city. At this particular time, I think that that's probably right. Beijing is pushing this extradition bill, and it really doesn't care about how many people in Hong Kong, as you said, seven, who are opposed to this.
The reason this is such an assault is it seems as though the Chinese can basically use this vehicle to seize and extradite anybody they consider to be a fugitive in Hong Kong, meaning no one is safe there from the long arm of the Chinese Ministry of State Security and the Communist Party of China. Would that be right?
And it's not only dissidents who worried about this. The business community is up in arms because they know that rapacious Chinese business people are very much willing to, you know, reach into Hong Kong and take their business partners. So you have a number of concerns among multinationals and the financial companies. And indeed, many people think that when this bill goes through, you'll see headquarters of companies move to Singapore, Tokyo, and the financial companies will come to New York, largely because they just want a safe jurisdiction. So this is a concern which is across Hong Kong's political spectrum and across Hong Kong society. And this is not just the dissidents.
Well, it shouldn't be just the people of Hong Kong. We have been, by an agreement with China since 1992, as I understand it, Gordon, enabling the Chinese to gain essentially duty-free access to our markets through a kind of free trade arrangement we've had with Hong Kong on the basis that China must respect the autonomy of this former British colony. It clearly is not doing that. Even the U.S. State Department in March seemed to say so, though they didn't argue that we needed to end this arrangement. But what are your thoughts on that, Gordon? Should we persist in pretending the Chinese are, you know, living up to their agreement with us as well as that to the British when they turned the place over to them?
Yeah, the issue here is U.S. export controls. Hong Kong has certain exemptions, and then, of course, those exemptions do not exist for the rest of the People's Republic of China. And I think at this particular time, with Beijing exercising influence and control over Hong Kong, that it's no longer appropriate to treat Hong Kong different than the rest of the People's Republic.
Especially since it allows the People's Republic to get access to our stuff in a way that they wouldn't otherwise, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there should be a cost on Beijing for this extradition bill and other things that they have been doing to cut down Hong Kong's economy. And this U.S. exemption for Hong Kong is where I think we start, making it clear to Beijing that we're no longer treating Hong Kong and giving it a special status.
Yeah. Well, if they don't, we certainly shouldn't, it seems to me, too. Gordon, let me switch gears. I listened to National Public Radio this morning, as I often do, and they were reporting a story, an interview with a fellow by the name of Andy Purdy, who was billed as a former U.S. government cybersecurity professional, and he's now working for a Chinese conglomerate we talk about with you most weeks, and necessarily so, called Huawei. He made a very impassioned argument that we really didn't need to worry about the sorts of things that the United States government is clearly very worried about with respect to Huawei, namely that it could be used by the Chinese government as a means of obtaining immense amounts of data on Americans and otherwise being able to manipulate and perhaps weaponize our communications and Internet of Things and all manner of other technologies that will be hooked up to a Huawei 5G modem or cell phones or what have you. You've looked at this long and hard. We talked about it with you and our colleagues in Dallas last week. Where do you think the truth lies on this?
Clearly, Huawei has been spying for China. We know this. There's one example. Between 2012 and 2017, China was every night downloading data from the headquarters of the African Union using Huawei servers. So this is not some theoretical concern. You know, with regard to Americans working for Huawei, there ought to be a law. You know, the Trump administration last month took some good steps with the emergency order, which will eventually lead to the prohibition on the purchase of telecom equipment from Huawei, and also Huawei being added to the Commerce Department's entity list, which then requires American businesses to get prior approval for sales or license to Huawei. But right now, there's a big move, even inside the White House, to grant exemptions and delay of these measures. And that's just wrong. You can grant maybe one delay in order to allow American companies to adjust, especially those that have Huawei equipment in their networks, give them time to take it out. But at this particular time, there should be no more exemptions than the one that was granted last month after the issuance of the executive order. And clearly right now, this is a test of will. As I mentioned, there might be a law that Americans officials, ex-officials, should not be working for Huawei.
Yeah, especially those that are lending their expertise in the cybersecurity domain to Huawei, for heaven's sakes. That would seem to me to be a serious national security problem, potentially at least. And Gordon, one of the concerns, I guess, that has arisen is that, as we saw with another Chinese telecommunications conglomerate, also tied to the People's Liberation Army, ZTE, President Trump was prevailed upon to essentially stand down on the very strong steps that the United States government had taken against ZTE for precisely these same kinds of reasons. There's now talk that the president will be meeting with his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping, president for life, if you will, of China, on the margins of the G20 meeting coming up here shortly in Asia. What do you think the prospects of the president, you know, essentially doing a similar kind of flip on Huawei might be, and the implications were he to do so?
Yeah. There's a real possibility of a flip on Huawei. You know, we just heard Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, talk about going easy on Huawei if there is a trade deal. And that echoes things that President Trump himself has said. Let me make this clear. There is no justification for giving Huawei a going easy on them if the Chinese agreed to favorable trade agreement. These are two separate issues. And we should not be compromising national security in order to get greater sales of, for instance, soybeans to the Chinese. The president is wrong on this, and Americans ought to mention and write to the White House, write to their senator, write to their congressman, write to Pompeo and the U.S. Commerce Department Secretary Wilbur Ross that this is just not acceptable.
Gordon Chang, you are, of course, on record saying there should be no trade deal and that the effect of doing one would be to prop up the Chinese Communist Party at a time when we certainly shouldn't be doing that again. I very much agree with that. And that would be enormously compounded as a very bad public policy outcome, a trade deal in these circumstances, if we were to also ease up on Huawei. Thank you, Gordon, for your clarity on these and so many other issues and for joining us each week. We'll look forward to talking with you again.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. Joined, I'm very pleased to say, once again by Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, a man who served for some 30 years as a naval intelligence officer, specifically focused on the Pacific and the rising threat from China. Among other things, he served in various capacities, leading American intelligence efforts for the Navy in the Pacific, including completing a tour as the capstone of his career as the Director of Intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. He is these days a senior fellow with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with ours. Jim Fennell, welcome back. Good to have you, sir.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
I thought of you immediately, Captain, because in recent days there was an incident, as they say, in the Western Pacific. I believe it's the East China Sea, where a Russian destroyer seemed to have very narrowly missed causing possibly fatal collision with a U.S. warship operating in those waters. The Russians, of course, are blaming the United States for this incident. The United States has confined itself to saying that it was unprofessional conduct on the part of the Russians. But what do you make of what's happening in this particular incident, as well as more generally in that part of the world towards our vessels and personnel?
Yeah, Frank, this is an interesting question. And my assessment is that Vladimir Putin was a little bit chagrined and miffed that he wasn't invited to the 75th anniversary of the D-Day ceremony, even though Angela Merkel and the Germans were. And so he basically issued an order, I think, to tell his forces to, maybe create some havoc with the U.S. So I think the day before this event in the, I think it's in the Philippines. See, we've had three locations, and I'll get back to that. But there was an event out in the Black Sea area where there was a Russian flanker that flew very close to one of our reconnaissance aircraft and I think thumped it. And you had this event where you clearly see the Admiral Vinogradov, which is a Utiloid destroyer, go straight at our ship, the USS Chancellorsville, in a just a straight on attack angle, and then come right up to it and then just kind of pull up parallel and then act like, hey, what's the problem? Well, the problem was, as the U.S. Pacific Fleet said, it was a very unprofessional and potentially dangerous maneuver. And I think Putin was trying to rein on the parade of the Western world as they remembered the dedication and service of the thousands and thousands of people that risked their lives to launch the invasion back into the continent of Europe to fight Nazi Germany. And I think, and to some degree, he failed in that because it didn't really disrupt those ceremonies. On the other hand, it was also interesting to note that Russian press had talked about the event happening both in the East China Sea and in the South China Sea. And so I think there was also a link there with President Xi, who he had just been meeting with in St. Petersburg. And I think there was probably some bit of an attempt there to show his friend, his compatriot, Xi Jinping, that, hey, guess what we can do? We can screw with the Americans in the Far East as well. And here, watch this.
That brings me to
both together.
That next question, which is, what are the Chinese doing in this vein as well? I understand that there have been laser attacks on American pilots, that there have been sonic attacks on our diplomats in China. Captain Fennell, tell us what the Chinese are doing that is, well, unprofessional, once again, or downright hostile.
I think, Frank, in terms of the PLA Navy, the official military of the Chinese Navy, their actions are, as many American Pacific Fleet and Seven Fleet spokesmen say, they're generally professional. But that doesn't mean that they're not putting pressure on us. And since October of 2015, every time a foreign warship enters the South China Sea, Chinese warships are shadowing our vessels and warning us and our allies that you're not allowed to operate in the South China Sea without our permission. And the same thing's actually happening in the East China Sea. So the Chinese are basically saying anything inside the first island chain is PRC territory, and you shouldn't be there without our permission because we interpret the United Nations Convention Law of the Sea, or UNCLOS, differently than the majority of the rest of the world. And then you get into specifics, like you mentioned, about these lazing events that have occurred in Djibouti, occurred in the South China Sea. We just had a report a week and a half ago from Australia that even Australian helicopter pilots off the HMAS Canberra were lazed by PRC fishing vessels that were in the area of these Australian ships, as were Chinese Navy combatants. So the Chinese are a bit more sophisticated than the Russians, who we, would characterize as being a bit more ham-fisted in some way, more overt in their poking at us.
But in both cases, this temptation to describe these things as simply unprofessional, it would seem to me, Jim Fennell, to be sort of lowballing the hostile intent behind what these two countries, which now seem to be working more and more and more in concert, are exhibiting vis-a-vis the United States.
Yeah, it's bullying. There's at a minimum, it's bullying. They're trying to, you know, pressure us to back out and to stop our operations and to of those of the other nations. And I was just in a conference in Geneva this week talking about the South China Sea this past week. And it was very evident from talking with the Europeans in the group that, you know, we've had British, we've had French, we have the Australians, we've had the Canadians, the Germans now are talking about future operations in the region. The French aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle is out in the region. So you're seeing the Western world and the international norms that have been established since the World War II. These nations now are starting to unify to say, hey, we're not going to accept this. We didn't accept it from the Soviet Union. And why should we accept it from the Chinese Communist Party and the PLA Navy and the PLA Air Force?
Yeah. Well, I have to say it's heartening that that's the case. Jim, let me just ask you one other question about this, and then we have to switch gears very briefly. But I do worry that whatever we're doing in the way of these freedom of navigation operations, as they're called, steaming within the 12-mile area of some of these manufactured islands that the Chinese have essentially created and now fortified and are using to project power throughout these waters, they have unsinkable aircraft carriers that give them a permanent presence there. We and maybe some of these allied nations can be interlopers, but basically the advantage goes to those who are there, as they say, facts on the ground. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's definitely true. The seven islands that they built in the last 5 years or so are there permanently. Three of them are large naval bases with 10,000. Three of them have 10,000 foot runways so that they can land any type of aircraft that they've had that they would like to put there. They've moved in surface to air missiles. They have revetments for fighter aircraft. And then, as I said, deep water ports so that even things as large as their newest aircraft carriers can pull in there, as well as their submarine force. So it's an issue that they took advantage of the previous administration that did nothing and allowed them to gain the foothold in there. And I just want to say that the Chinese are not just challenging us inside 12 nautical miles around these, features and these, they're not called islands. You know, the Court of Arbitration, didn't accept that those were formerly islands. They were features. And so they're not entitled to any exclusive economic zone or anything else. But the Chinese are not just challenging us there. They're challenging our ships when they enter the South China Sea side of these disputed areas. So they're anything inside the 9-dash line. They're saying, hey, why are you here? You didn't ask our permission. This is really the outrageous point of what they're doing.
Yeah. And they're making the same demands, as I understand it, of commercial shipping as well. Is that right? That everybody has to seek their permission to transit these international waters now?
They haven't done that yet. So commercial vessels haven't been disrupted. But how do we know they won't go there when they get upset over something like rare earth elements or some other economic thing that they want to embargo or touch on?
The trade deal, for example, is something they're pretty hot about, that's for sure. Jim Fennell, thank you for your distinguished service in uniform and that you continue to provide now at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. Come back to us again soon. Hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.